Coming up on today's episode of the Salesman Podcast.
Be real careful because we can get sucked into how we look, okay? In terms of my image, reputation, my LinkedIn, you know, my resume and what I've been, where I've been published or whatever. I get that. It's important, you know, foot in the door credibility. But enough about you, it's about your customer.
Hello, Sales Nation, I'm Will Barron, host of the Salesman Podcast, the world's most listened to B2B sales show, where we help you not just hit your sales targets, but really thrive in sales. Make sure you click subscribe if you haven't already, and let's meet today's guest.
My name is Paul Cherry, and I'm president of Performance-Based Results, author of Questions That Sell, and also the Ultimate Sales Pro. Excited to be here to share innovative ideas to help you take charge of your sales process, get more sales with less effort.
On this episode of the show, Paul, we're diving into the difference between high-performing sales professionals and the ones that are just plodding along and doing average. We dive into the mindset differences between them, physical skills that they have, the different questions that they're asking, and a whole lot more. So with that, let's jump right in. To get us started and give a ton of value up front with this episode of the show, what would be, if you had to narrow it down, gun to head, the most impactful or highest leverage thing that high-performing salespeople do that the average salesperson just simply doesn't?
You want me to narrow it down to one thing, is that right?
And then we'll come on to the rest of them, but the highest impact thing, perhaps.
The highest impact thing would be think more conceptually versus product focus. That would be it, okay?
And what does that look like in practical terms?
Yes, exactly. So all that means is, too often we go in talking products when we really need to be thinking, engaging customers on solutions, which just means four things. Can I minimize their risk? Can I give them a competitive edge? Can I make them more profitable? And or can I make them more successful or simplify their lives? That's what I mean by that conceptual solution-focused approach versus feature benefit dump.
And I'm sure there's about 15 episodes that we could do, or there's definitely four episodes that we could do on each one of these specific points. But how do we make the leap? And this will tie into perhaps other things that high-performing sales reps do that the average don't. How do we take that leap from, well, I've only really had training on my product and the features and benefits, but I know, and regular listeners will know, that they need to be selling solutions and solving problems. How do people make that leap from one thing, which is seemingly you can learn from a spreadsheet, to another, which seemingly is experience and expertise based?
Yeah, no, that's that absolutely. Nothing, there's no better training, and I'm in sales training. That's what I do. And so I may talk myself out of this, but the best training is go out and get beat up. Okay, what does that mean? Go out and call on a higher level executive or business owner. And I say that because when you call on a higher level executive or decision maker at the top, they're always thinking, you know, conceptually, the bigger picture in terms of how they're running their business. They're not thinking products. And the challenge is, if we go in at a low end talking with somebody in purchasing, then it's all about products, you know, availability, pricing. You see what it, so what will happen is that that higher level decision maker, if you try attempt to talk product-based selling, they'll push you right down or kick you out. And you realize after a few sales calls, maybe 10 or 12, like, this ain't working. So that's what I mean about, you know, calling higher up. Because you'll learn real fast the purpose of engaging people. It's really about their needs and challenges and opportunities. And then just being patient and plug in how your product or service can address those needs. That's all. It's as simple as that.
How do we then, so we're average, quote unquote average, perhaps we're hitting our sales target, but we see people who are smashing the sales target. And maybe if the commission structure, depending on how it's set up, they're doing double the take home that we are every year. And we're like, damn, we need to get in with these individuals. And perhaps this is the answer to the question. Perhaps we need to spend time with them. But how do we go then from, we've been beat up on the phone, we know that we should be doing this, how do we take that step up? Do we need mentoring? Do we need to hire a coach? Do we need sales training? What do we need to do to take things to the next level?
Yeah, so it's here's what, and as you know, my passion is all about it's listening and understanding the needs of our customers. So to keep it simple as possible, target what I call your ideal vertical market. So, you know, depending on the industry that you're in, I know last time we talked about medical, but it could be applied to any concept. So where is it most promising opportunities based on the economy and based on your market? So it's just a matter of, okay, you know, who's willing to spend money and where you have some traction opportunities. So the reason why you see these salespeople who are doing really well, it's because they're not just trying to like, oh, I don't want to come across greedy or whatever. You'll hear that from salespeople. And it's like, greedy? It's not a matter of being greedy. It's creating and understanding the need. So you're not like going in there, well, let me just kind of like warm up the relationship, sell a few products or services, get my foot in the door, get them comfortable, me to like me or whatever, and then we'll kind of move along. No. You get in there and if you identify need, you want to be able to upsell and cross-sell your entire portfolio. Why not? I mean, the paradigm shift, though, Will, is I deal with salespeople all the time who just like, well, let me just do sell a few and let's see how things go. And no, you're conditioning the customer to like spread the love around, they'll say, to all your competitors as well as you.
So there seems like there's two levels to this, and we'll come on to selling skills of the high performers, what they're doing differently in a second, which is seemingly question-based selling. Listening skills, active listening, and creating a need and perhaps creating some kind of scarcity or some urgency to get the deal done. So we'll come on to that in a second, sales skills. But you brought up something else interesting here, Paul, of what is the difference in the mindset between someone who is a crazy high performer and someone who is average?
Having the self-comp concept. And when I say the good, strong self-comp concept means having the confidence that you are an equal. Okay, to that prospective opportunity. It sounds easy on paper, Will, but it's knowing that, having the confidence, the stamina, and knowing that you really do bring value, meaning that, you know, based on your success with a similar customer or opportunity in terms of what you can bring to the table. So in other words, Will, the reason for my call is to share some ideas on how we're able to, with this other client in which they're achieving, you know, the following dollars and expanding market share, eliminating that. Why I'm calling you is to see how, you know, we can provide possibly some similar opportunities. But to find out, let me ask you some questions. And then you just set the stage to engage and probe and kind of come across as credible, if that makes sense. And I'm talking prospective opportunities here versus an established relationship, all right? But I mean, not going around fishing around. does that make sense?
It makes total sense. And I was just going to give an analogy of me, because I've never had this problem of feeling inferior to someone in a nicer suit wearing a nicer Rolex than what I have. And this is due to just pure ignorance, as opposed to I'm supremely confident in my sales skills. Of when I got into my first medical device sales job, I didn't realize that the rest of my team weren't spending a lot of time with the CFO and the CEO of the hospital. I assumed that we all should be doing it. And so I went and did it and clearly made a fool out of myself a bunch of times, not knowing the language and how to communicate with them. But I just then continued this. And it was only at the later part of my medical device selling career when I started to invite, well, I didn't invite, I had a couple of trainees and other people that came out because I was more senior in the role at that point. And they'd be going, well, Barry isn't taking us to see these individuals. He's always just with the surgeon or the theatre staff. Why have you got the ability to get in front of these individuals? And then it clicked that, oh, not everyone else is doing this. So other than just being totally ignorant like myself, or maybe we should be, maybe this is the answer, Paul, should we be faking it until we make it with some of the mindset elements of this?
No, but I thank you for that example because the medical device is a great example. So calling on a surgeon or calling on a doctor, there's a tendency to talk more product-based. In other words, you want to be respectful of the doctor's time. You have maybe 3, 4, or 5 minutes max. So it's like, you know, we fall into the trap of giving the pitch because it's much more technical and we want to be respectful of that person's time. So that's classic. So there's where I call the technical product base. But then how do we switch gears? Because when you're going to call on somebody, let's say a CFO, that's all different because it's all about the financial or the return on investment. You know, in terms of creating value, return on investment, more market share, the hospital differentiating itself from other competitive players out there, totally different language. So how do I be a chameleon to switch from what I call technical to financial based selling? See, that's it. That's so the salesperson who can really master that, that's why they're able to double or triple their business because they're not hesitant to switch gears.
And how do we learn to switch gears? Is this just a time in the role, getting on with it, and the experience that comes from that? Is this something that, you know, some people can't, no one picks up quickly? Is this something that we just got to immerse ourselves with a bunch of CFOs, and we start to pick up the language that they're using and their wants and needs? Or is there a shortcut or a hack to becoming a, and this seems like a title of a book, a sales chameleon?
Yeah, it's understanding how each and every individual is measured. So let's talk purchasing, for example. If I call on purchasing and my relationship is limited to purchasing, I'm going to get stuck into what's important to them. And typically, Will, it's going to be pricing and availability. Okay, so let's say then, okay, now I go expand my conversation. Now I need to talk to somebody more in operations. So let's say it's technical or engineering. All of a sudden, when I start asking what's important to you or what do you value, then the conversation switches to typically like quality, durability, the warranties, and possibly support. You see what I mean? And then when I go higher up, let's say it's somebody at a director or senior level, then they're thinking more about the bigger picture in terms of that, not price savings, but really about profitability, okay? Growth, greater success. So all I need to do, understand from each, is just ask the questions. Tell me what's important to you. What are you trying to accomplish? Okay. That's the only way I got to sell to the needs of each and every individual. And it's a matter of just pulling the pieces of the puzzle together, so I don't get into the commoditized trap where I start talking about pricing. Because if I limit my relationships, my conversations, then I'm going to get stuck in what's important to that person, which is very limited perspective. Make sense?
Makes total sense. What questions then, because clearly this is key to all of this. What questions we go for kind of 3 points within a meeting. The initial kind of, you sat down in front of someone, they don't know you, like you, or trust you just yet. What questions does a high-performance salesperson ask versus an average person? The middle of the meeting when there's a bit of trust and you're kind of going a bit deeper. And then what questions at the end of the meeting does to wrap things up, to gain commitment, to move things forward? What questions does a high-performing salesperson ask perhaps at the end of the meeting as well?
Yes. And so let me bypass the introduction, because, you know, that always sets the stage, but you and I could spend 30 minutes on that. So let's just assume, though, that one had, you know, a nice message, you know, just, you know, the value opening statement, elevator pitch, or whatever we would call it, but to instill some credibility. So assuming salesperson did a good job on that, and I know they did, here's what we have to come in with humility. And it goes something like this. Well, it's important that, enough about me, I'm here to learn about you and your needs. So to find out if what we provide is a good fit with what you're trying to accomplish, may I ask you some questions? Okay. Now, that's tough for some salespeople, because they want to go in there hard charging. And remember, a prospective opportunity, that person's defensive, because they're like, oh, I know you're trying to sell me, and I'm going to be very protective in terms of what I want to share with you. So I want to earn the right to ask questions so that people will open up. All right. So to answer your question, I would say is, let's talk about what value means to you. That's the question. Let's talk about what's important to you when it comes to, it could be your job, your goals, your needs. That's the question. It's simple. And you can frame it, of course, in terms of what, you know, the industry or whatever. But that's what I want to ask. And I'll give you an example, because you said medical device.
Yep.
Here's a quick example. CEO, president of a company. Let's see, 10 seconds of the conversation, CEO just shut the salesperson down and said, "Why do I want to buy from you? You're $10,000 more than your competition, and your technology is inferior." How do you respond to that? See what I mean? And the salesperson said, "You know, I really do appreciate you sharing that with me. After all, it's important that you get a good return for your investment. Let me ask you, what does value mean to you and your business?" And so this guy was in the medical area, and he said, "What value means to me is, you know, making money, ease of use, and eliminating risk." And so he just found out three criteria. And he said, "You know, when it comes to making money, let's talk about the advanced technology. How many patients can you work on with the advanced versus ours?" And it turns out, two more patients a day with the current, with his platform. Number two, it was about ease of use. And he said, "Okay, with the newer technology, it means two clinicians working on that versus one with ours. What's it cost you to hire, train, and maintain an additional clinician?" It's like $200,000. Okay, number three, eliminating risk. New technology means learning curve, and that means out of your comfort zone and taking risks or whatever, which means what if you're one of your clinicians, you know, we're just a fraction of a millimeter off that spine where it needs to be. What's the implication on you and your business? And the CEO said, you kidding me? We're talking multi-million-dollar lawsuits. Now, bottom line was 45 minutes later, what do you think the salesperson walked away with? a purchase order. Because it was the question was, let's talk about what value means to you and your business. Because what on surface, what comes up, Will, is what people value, their criteria, okay? And everybody has a different, you know, definition of criteria. But it's my job to dig deep, broad, and high within that key account to get everybody's perspective.
I love this question because it's seemingly something that you can ask. Maybe you don't ask it multiple times over multiple meetings, but you can ask it to anyone, right?
Thank you. And you know what? That's exactly what we want to do is we want to ask things that are repetitive, that I don't have to get so original and creative, because salespeople are just, you know, in fairness, we all know the importance of planning, but enough that all I can do is tweak the question a little bit, but it's something repetitive I can ask again and again. Absolutely.
So, and I love that about this, because where I was going with this before, and this is the hack, I guess, this is the shortcut of, I was going, well, do we need to do loads of research? You know, we do need to do some research, but do we need to know the ins and outs of all this? Do we need to predict things? And if it's as simple as just asking a question and then we get the answer from the person that we're speaking to, as opposed to making assumptions, all of this is going to flow a lot more easy. And with that, Paul, I feel like this might be a differentiator. You can tell me if it is between high-performing and average salespeople. But how important is the ability to ask a question and then shut the hell up afterwards? Because asking the question, what does value mean to you? As soon as I visualize myself saying it, I then go, oh, there's a weird silence. Does it mean this? Does it mean that? Does it mean this? And then you're either leading someone down a pathway that perhaps they weren't planning on going down, obviously manipulative, and you're limiting your ability to build trust with them at that point, but you're trying to just fill dead air. How important is it to be able to ask a, not a challenging question, but a question that makes someone think like that, and then just sit back and, I don't know whether you're counting sheep in your head or you're doing something to take your mind off the fact that there's an awkward silence, but how important is that ability to cope with silence?
That's, you nailed it, because when we go through our live exercises, salespeople fall into that trap where it's manipulating and trying to force them down a path. I think that's nervousness, anxiousness, trying to funnel somebody. It's just empower the customer. But you said it well, and that is just, you know, less is more. And tell me what value means to you and your team. Shut up. You're right. Is it pricing? Is it availability? Is it services? Is it warranty? It's like, where are you going with this? You just threw in five questions. One question, and it's just, it's the fear. It's the fear and anxiety. That's what it is. So practice is what is key for that. Yeah.
Well, that was going to be the next question. And is practice the only solution? Is that the only thing that we should be looking at? And what does practice look like practically? Is it role plays with managers, with the other people in your sales team? How do we reduce this level of fear? Of silence.
Here's what I suggest is that one can easily just go in the mirror and just start practicing some simple questions. So one of those would be is, tell me what value means to you and your people. Tell me what value means to you and your organization. Tell me what value means to you and your customers. And I like asking, there's two things that's embedded there. Value, because that automatically gets away from the price conversation, because value means many things. Also, too, what I say is value means to you and your, there's people embedded in there, which means I need to understand a decision-making process. See the simplicity? So just get in front of the mirror and just ask it 10 times, see? Or 20 times when you're driving. Just, you know, sure, it makes sense to get with your peers and your bosses, whatever. But, Will, you know, most managers are not very good at coaching and training. So salespeople need to take ownership and just take the initiative and do it themselves, coach themselves. Take a recording, listen to it with your smartphone. It's as simple as that, not complicated, but good question. Yes, practice, practice.
We're going to come back to what we kind of touched on before of the questions that we should be asking at the end of a meeting, a phone call in a second. But something you brought up here, is there a gap in the amount of responsibility that a high-performing salesperson takes for their work, their action, their output, everything they do? Is do they take more responsibility for themselves and their success than perhaps an average person, or is that non-existent?
Oh, I love that. You just, you know, you hit on something, and a very important nerve. Sure, they take more responsibility. But the paradigm is that they get this, the customer or the prospect to take on more responsibility. What I mean by that, Will, is they get the customer to have skin in the game. So part of that process, and I'm talking more of a, not a one call close, which is great. I mean, but most of us have to have multiple steps, you know, multiple people involved. So under that context, it's the next step. So, you know, you and I have a great meeting. I'm not going to allow this opportunity where you would say, well, okay, this sounds really good. Why don't you get back with me in a couple of weeks and we'll see what, no, no, no. We take ownership. And part of that process is, okay, well, let's do this. Let's talk about scheduling a meeting, a next meeting, and we pencil it down into the calendar, whatever. That's common sense. But the next step then, Will, is here's what I would like to do. And then I want to ask, what can you do? So I want you to do something. And that would be a next step. It could be involving other people from your team in the conversation as a next step. So there's a commitment of time, money, resources, or opportunity on your part as a customer prospect that is part of taking on more responsibility. So we're both taking on responsibility.
And that's a buying signal, right? If someone is willing to take some time out of their diary, because some people might just turn around and go, no. You do the work, you're the salesperson, and clearly they're just not invested at that point.
Well, yes, and that's where it's and even then I you have some people who really have a lot of customers have a lot of free time, which tells you their job can't be that important. So I'm even looking for more than just them willing to give some time on their diary calendar, which is good, but it's also saying, can they take a step? Are they willing to pilot? Are they willing to travel and meet me somewhere? Are they going to come to a prospective opportunity to evaluate, you know, and again, to test something, pilot something, spend a few dollars that shows sincerity that they value the relationship to move it forward and evolve. Yeah. That's going to be important. So it's, you know, we talk about always be closing, which I used to hate that expression, but really we always got to be closing on each and every conversation. It's critical. And not rely on email communication as being the tool for selling. It supports us, but it is not a sales or negotiating tool. It'll get us into trouble, if anything, if we try to let that take over from, you know, either face-to-face or phone conversations. Those take precedence over email correspondence, which I love, just to kind of validate and let's confirm a next step, but not to sell a next step.
Tell us a little bit why, Paul, why email negotiations, especially why that is not a good idea.
And it's because, for example, somebody is showing interest in what we have to provide and they know the pricing, whatever. So then they come back and say as well, we're finding that we can't afford it. We really would like to see if you could reduce it by 15 or 20%. Can we get your input on that to do that? Send me back if that's doable. Now, if I want to please the customer or really I'm hungry to get the business, the easy cop out would be is, all right, let me talk to my manager or whatever. And then we come back, either we get close to it or let's just say we can meet it. It doesn't matter. The fact is, even if we meet it, the person can hide behind that email and say, well, let me think about it. And so I'll get back to you in a few weeks. And what do? They took that information. They're shopping around. All I'm saying here is this, is that customers can hide behind and some be manipulative or exploit the situation. I don't have access to what I call the body language or the vocal elements, intonation to help read or decipher or get a commitment. Not that that's a guarantee, but I'll make much greater progress to tell if somebody's sincere or not. But email, I can't. I lose all that, all the body language and the vocal elements. All right. And as you know, we've seen these studies. It's been from University of California, I think at Berkeley. So it's like, you know, the three things that impact the communication process. And it was like our words is 7%. So if you try to do that by email, now all of a sudden what's 7% in a live encounter now becomes 100%. No. One will lose. Thank you.
And I feel it just to go a level deeper than that and come back to questioning for a second, it limits our ability to ask good questions because I feel like a lot of the questions, like this one we keep going back to of what does value mean to you? That's not the first thing that you ask in a conversation. Clearly, you have a bit of rapport, you have a chat, you know, I was the traffic getting over, it was great, you know, I just saw Sue in the hallway and blah, blah, blah. And then you start to ask these questions. Whereas on an email, there is no warm up because the email is a quick communication platform, right? And so you lose the opportunity to perhaps ask these deep questions, which separate you from the competition and allow you to, as an individual, to give value to the potential customer, as opposed to it all being what we talked about at the top of the show, which is all being based on features and benefits.
Yes. And so, thank you for bringing that up, because so if somebody were to counter me in an email saying, oh, you know, you need to bring it down by another $500. So rather than trying to do the correspondence, just say, let's get on the phone, because I have a few questions. See, and just say, let me think about it or talk to some people about it. But I need to get on the phone. So what I want to do is decipher and, okay, where are we? What are you trying to accomplish? Oh, in the negotiators, it just comes down to what do I need to take out or what do you need to take out, all right, so that we can achieve the right outcome. Or by chance, if there is still enough margins to protect, I can gauge to say, without making a commitment, say, wow, Will, $500 less. Woo, my goodness. I'm just curious, Will. I have no clue because I have to talk to my internal team, but I'm just curious, you know, what if we were to, you know, meet that, what you're looking for? What are you telling me? Are you going to give me the business? See, and I'm going to be like, your answer or lack of answer is going to tell me everything, whether you're playing a game or you're really sincere. You see what I mean? Which I'm jumping into sort of heavy negotiating here, but those are things I can only find out in a live conversation. I will not get an email correspondence.
Good, okay? Good. Well, I think we've clarified that point. I appreciate that, Paul. Something here that I feel like is becoming more and more important. You can tell me if I'm talking nonsense, but I feel like a personal brand is another way that you can differentiate yourself against everyone else in the marketplace. If you're known as the expert, as I again, inadvertently, I didn't plan all this, but in my medical device sales role, regular listeners will know this, I worked for both the two biggest companies in the space. They owned the endoscopy market, you know, to kind of 96, 97% of it anyway. So I knew all my products, I knew all the competitors' products kind of from both sides. So that set me up as somewhat of an expert. People would call me when my competition's products had broken, there was issues, because I was always more available than the rep that they had lived miles away, whereas I could just pop in on my way home. So I got into accounts, did loads of stuff on this front. So is there a gap then between the average salesperson and the high performer on the personal brand? And what do we need to do as an average person perhaps to raise our personal brand up to these levels if there is a gap?
So the personal brand, here's the paradigm shift is, we want to be real careful, because we can get sucked into how we look, okay, in terms of my image, reputation, my LinkedIn, you know, my resume, and where I've been published or whatever. I get that. It's important, you know, foot in the door credibility. But enough about you. It's about your customer. It's creating a great brand. It's all about showing that genuine interest. And it's just doing some, you know, basic homework. It takes me 2-3 minutes before I'm going to call you, jump on their LinkedIn profile, see where they've been published or where they've been recognized, award, reputation, some new product launch, something I can leverage. Say, hey, Will, you know, the reason for my reaching out is because, you know, I see that I read something about you that was wonderful and it did this and did that. Hey, while I'm calling, I got a few ideas on how you can. See, that's what I mean about showing that credibility and leveraging that I did just enough homework that it isn't just a, you know, hey, I want to sell you a product, but it shows that, you know, I did a little due diligence and I show respect to connect with people. That's truly great branding. To connect with people on a personal level. And I don't think people do that today, Will, like they used to. And yet, Will, there's just so much easily, readily accessible information on people today that didn't exist 20 years ago. And yet salespeople just, I'm like, I'll say, okay, what homework did you, well, I went on their website. I'm like, okay, well, come on, a little bit more. And it, trust me, it takes 5 minutes, 10 minutes max before I'll pick up the phone and call somebody, okay?
Sales Nation, this episode of the show is brought to you by salesschool.org. 84% of all sales training is lost after 90 days. Well, that makes it clear to me that sales training is well and truly dead. Regardless of that, why would you be relying on someone else to determine your earning potential by providing you with sales training anyway? Now, listening to the podcast is an amazing first step to improving your income potential, but there are levels to this game. And with salesschool.org, you can take your self-development into your own hands. We publish a brand new, entertaining, exclusive one-hour workshop in the sales school every single week. We cover everything from prospecting to the science behind becoming instantly more charismatic. There's audio downloads, cheat sheets, workshops, and a whole lot more for all of our content as well. If you enjoy the podcast, then you're going to love the Sales School. And for a very limited amount of time, if you head over to salesman.org/school, I'm giving you 50% off your membership. That's 50% off for life. It's as simple as that. salesman.org/school. Jump in there today. Where's the balance, Paul, between, because we're on the same wavelength here, and the show heavily promotes what you're describing as opposed to just call. So what is the balance then between asking, I'll give you context. You could probably, without doing any research, get on the phone, ask some incredible questions and get away with it, right? You could, you're so skilled in it, you've literally written the book on it, that you could probably get away with doing minimal research and asking great, powerful questions that pull all the answers that you need to continue a conversation. Whereas someone who isn't as expertised as yourself, and hopefully people will be over the years moving forward, they need to do more homework so that they are asking educated questions at the top of the conversation because they don't have that experience that you have. So where is the balance then between homework and exceptional questions? Because I don't want the audience to think, well, if I ask a couple of good questions, I can get away with not doing any of the hard work beforehand. Where's the balance between the two?
Yeah, and thank you for that. You know, even myself, because even if my gift is in the ability to ask, you know, great questions, in fairness, if I don't have credibility with somebody, they'll just blow me off. So it's even that's irrelevant. It is a balance. So knowing that I know something about your marketplace trends or whatever. I'll give you an example. We had, I won't mention who the company, number one player one of the top players, I should say, in the diabetic medications, pharmaceutical. And we were working with what we call medical science liaisons. And they're just the high level, they're the doctors, pharmacists, advanced nurses that have off-label discussions. So these are very intelligent people. They're not in the sales role. They're in that advisory role. So the company brought us in because they were concerned because if there was no new data for these folks, they had nothing to talk about when they were meeting cohorts in the field. And I'm like, you know, you are the eyes and ears of what's going on in the marketplace. And this applies to any salesperson. Think about how many customers and prospects you're talking to on a daily basis. Articles, research, trade associations that you're attending. You have a pulse and you need to leverage that pulse because you bring ideas to the table that others don't. So don't think of yourself as just as a salesperson schlepping around calling products, but you're reaching out because of what you're seeing and what you're hearing in the marketplace. And enough to say, you know, the reason why I'm reaching out to you is, well, because we're seeing some issues going on, trends. We're seeing X, Y, and Z. I'm curious as to what you're seeing. Now, if I can come across credible, something specific, but again, I'm not in the sales pitch, but obviously, hey, this is intelligent. What you're right, I am seeing. And I'll put two or three things out there because I don't know what a person will latch on to. But they'll grab one or two and say, let's talk about it. You see, that's it. It's as simple as that. So it isn't about, hey, my name's Paul Cherry. I'm president of performance-based results. You know, I've worked with 1,200 companies to date. And, you know, we're 84% of our clients realize, I'd like to talk and see if you'd be interested in sales training. See, because that's about me.
Yep.
It's not about you. So that,
what's your opening? If you were to cold call someone right now, and we will wrap up with this and then one more question. But what if you could cold call a Oracle, Salesforce, huge kind of enterprise organization?
Yes.
What research would you do kind of briefly? What would be a high level bit of research you'd do? Who would you call upon? And then what would your like opening 10 seconds on the phone be?
And here's the easiest way to do it for every salesperson. The marketplace. Okay. So if you're talking about, you know, that's its cloud-based, you know, solutions or high-tech solutions, plug it into Google and then type in 2018 to 2023 trends, challenges, and opportunities. The first page, something will pop up and it takes you, you'll find something in 60 seconds, an article or research report. And you're able to just say, hey, Will, you know, the reason I'm reaching out to you is because I came across an article. I came across a report published in, and it talks about these two key challenges in your industry. We bring experience to the table on those issues. I'd like to schedule a time when you and I can talk because I have a few ideas. How's next Wednesday at 10 o'clock? See what I mean? It's as simple as that.
Yes, I love it. I love
it. It's simple. So it depends on the market.
Yeah.
And that's all. But that's what I mean about it being so readily available. I do not need to spend an hour. I just grab, just the first paragraph or two and then run with it.
Cool. I've got so one more question and one question to ask everyone that comes on the show, Paul. We can probably do a full 4 or 5 hour workshop on this if we put our minds together. But if you could give us an insight, because I don't know the answer to this, if you could give us an insight on it, it would be awesome. And it would set the tone for the audience for the rest of the day. If they're listening to this, probably, as they're driving into work or they're commuting. If you've got high performance salespeople on one side, you've got average performing salespeople on the other, which one of them focuses on getting lots of calls done, lots of people in the pipeline, and then closing lots of business? And which one of them perhaps has more of a slant towards long-term relationship building, less people in the funnel, but perhaps upselling, cross-selling, and selling more products to the same accounts? If there is a separation, I don't know if there is, but if there is one, which tactic, strategy is the average person doing, and what tactic or strategy is the high-performance salesperson doing?
Oh, this is it, though. Now, thank you. That's a wonderful question. You want it? It's two words. Get real. That's it. And when they say get real, get genuine with people. And it's because, we're bombarded. Everybody's pushed to try to do more, get more done. And the reality is I call it a spray and pray approach, which means you're trying to, and I realize that companies are pushing us, you got to close more, you got to get more, you got to win more. But the challenge is we're on the surface. And when you're on the surface, all you're doing is getting a lot of nuggets, getting a lot of minnows. Yeah. And all I mean about getting genuine is that we need to really develop these relationships at a more, what I call, business intimate level. And when you do, because that's what people really want. And the faces with the changes going on in society today, people are more distrustful, more cynical. They have access to more information. They really do value the relationships, despite what we're hearing about, I can get your product for this price, or I can buy it on Amazon or whatever. It's that because we're overwhelmed, make my life easier. So if I trust you and I like you and you can make sure that you're making me look good, you're making my life easier or making me more successful, I will do business with you despite me pummeling you on the price area. Find other, other ways. Does that make sense? And I say that because even my own business, Will, I work with half the clients that I worked with 5 years ago and 3 times the amount of revenue. Why? Because I'm getting more deeper, understanding deeper, broader, and higher within the organization, these relationships to become a strategic partner, not a product pusher. That's what I recommend to all your salespeople. Will make a huge difference. And bottom line is, don't sell value, because if you try to sell value, you're making assumptions here. Understand what customers value. And when you understand it, then you tailor, the solution so it's very meaningful and specific to what they're looking for.
What you described, and I love the analogy that you gave us there of your business, because clearly owning a business is slightly different to selling a B2B product, but I still sell all the ad space on the show. I proactively, purposefully do it so that I can test everything that we talk about here. And I found that it's far easier to sell for me to sell someone to sponsor the show for a quarter than it is kind of, 3-4 times more revenue than it is for someone to sponsor, for me to sell a sponsorship for 1 show, 3 shows, 4 shows. Because immediately, as you build deeper relationships with these individuals, they want to proactively, especially if you give them a strong ROI, they want to proactively not sponsor this and that. And I've got, for everyone listening to this on the audio, I've got Salesman Magazine here on the desk. The sponsorships that were done for that are nothing to do with the sales industry. They just want to be in front of affluent individuals in the business space. There's watch manufacturers in there. There's all kinds of brands. And all this has come from going higher up the food chain and saying, look, I don't want to just do one deal with you. I want to cross-sell you. I want to have you sponsor the podcast. I want you in the magazine. We've got a new podcast launching to promote the sales school that we've got. Hopefully, if it all kind of pulls together, one brand is sponsoring that for the next 12 months. I just feel like it's a no-brainer. But with that said, Paul, and as I'm saying this, I'm putting myself back in time to when I was in that medical device sales role. How do we go from, it's one thing to say all this, that build deep relationships and just sell to 5 people and smash your target rather than trying to spam 50 people to get close to your target. Are there any practical steps that we can take to make that shift practically within our kind of our marketplace? Is there anything that people who sell to two people and crush their sales targets rather than spamming 50 of them a month with phone calls and emails? Is there anything that we need to do to, I use the terms loosely, of relationship sell versus spam sell? What do we need to do to make the shift from one to the other?
Yeah, here's the nice thing. So your audience can walk away. Contrary to, people in my profession try to make it a complicated process so they can sell this great new and innovative solution, the latest and greatest. Mm-hmm. Let's get real here, okay? Let me tell your audience, and there's three things, okay? And things don't change, okay? It'll be like this 50 years from now. The three things for success, okay, in the sales world. Number one, ask the right questions. Okay, and when you're asking the right questions, you get into the real information. Okay, which means leads to you're qualifying the right opportunities. Okay, when you qualify the right opportunities, you know who to move into your funnel and who you need to get rid of. Okay, let go. So in and out. So focus, and it develops the clarity of focus. And the third is engaging the right people. Okay, so. Which really covers, that's why I don't limit myself to a certain relationship. I'm expanding that network within that key account, digging broad, high, and low to ensure that I really am building the relationship. So those three things, the right questions, with the right opportunities, and the right people. And you will definitely close more sales at the right margins. Doesn't get any easier than that, right, Will?
I love it. Love it. There's the very practical takeaway for the audience. And with that, Paul, one final question that I ask everyone that comes on the show. I think I asked you this last time. I can't remember. If you could go back in time, Paul, and speak to your younger self, what would be the one piece of advice you'd give him to help him become better at selling?
The biggest barrier to our success. It's not the marketplace, not the competition, not the pricing, not the having the latest product, whatever. It's ourselves. And I know from, the self-concept, self-confidence, and it's just stop hesitating, jump in and do it. That's how we build confidence. And we have that success, we grow. So I would have said, take more risks earlier, quicker, and faster. That would be my advice.
Amazing stuff. I appreciate that. And that, what a message to leave the audience with. And with that, Paul, tell us where we can find out more about you. We've mentioned two of your books. So tell us where we can find out about both of them as well.
Yeah, I'd go to my website, Paul Cherry, all one word, my name, paulcherry.com. And then you can visit. We have a ton of resources, 75 best of the best questions to close more opportunity. It's invaluable. We got, the qualifying resources and so forth. Yes, go there. Reach out to me, Cherry at P as in peanut, B as in boy, results.com. They will have a question, and I'd be more than happy to respond for clarity on things that we covered in this show. Absolutely. My pleasure.
Good stuff. And tell us about the new book as well.
And the Ultimate Sales Pro, and that is what the best salespeople do differently. And that's all about getting salespeople out of their paradigms and to be doing those things that's going to put them in control. Things that we cover today, as I said, it's not about your marketplace and the competition, whatever. It's because the average salesperson changes jobs in the first 10 years, probably changes jobs at least 5 times now. It's a crazy world today. Companies aren't investing the time, money, and resources like they did 20 years ago. The whole book premise is that you got to take charge and take ownership of your career. How do you do that? By developing and coaching yourself and empowering yourself with the tools and concepts, because you can't wait for other people to do it. You got to do it. And so it gives you the roadmap on how to get there to master these skills quicker, faster, and easier. Okay.
Powerful stuff. Well, with that, Paul, I'll link to all this in the show notes over at salesman.org. And with that, thank you for your experience on this. I thank you for, you give us a couple of personal anecdotes of things that you do. I appreciate that, because I always feel a bit bad when I ask those questions. I'm putting someone very purposefully on the spot. So you handled it amazingly. I appreciate that, mate. And thanks again for joining us on the Salesman Podcast.
Thank you, Will. It's been my pleasure.